Welcome to the ABR podcast, where some of Australian Book Review's contributors read their articles or discuss them with ABR staff. My name is Peter Rose, and I'm the editor of ABR. If you enjoy these podcasts, think about subscribing to the magazine. Those 25 and under can do so for as little as $25 for the online version, or just $60 for print plus online.
My name is Tracy Ellis. Earlier this year, my essay, Flow States, won the 2023 Calibre Essay Prize. I was so thrilled to win this award. It's been a real honour. Now, the 2024 Calibre Prize is underway with a closing date of January 22. ABR is seeking essays of all kinds, personal or political, literary or speculative, traditional or experimental. This prize, open to writers in English around the world, is a wonderful opportunity for writers established or emerging. Full details appear on the ABR website. Good luck.
In this week's ABR podcast, poet, novelist and speechwriter Joel Dean asks what we can glean about the state of Australian politics from the outcome of the Voice referendum. Dean argues that one person more than any other is the reason why more than 60% of voters said no. And that person is not a current Australian politician. Such figures, he says, haunt Australian politics like Hamlet's ghost. Joel Dean has worked for the Australian Labor Party as a speechwriter, and his latest novel is Judas Boys. Here is Joel Dean with A Maddening Country, The Long Political Shadow of John Howard, published in the December issue of ABR.
Why did Australia vote against the Voice referendum? Alastair Campbell, former communications chief to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, blames the media. Speaking on his The Rest is Politics podcast, Campbell likened opposition leader Peter Dutton's rogue interventions in the debate to the misinformation he saw in the Brexit campaign of 2016. Quote, Dutton claimed the referendum was rigged and the media didn't really challenge him on it. They covered it as a big row, a little bit like what we had in the Brexit campaign, where lies were told and the lies then became part of the narrative. And the media is no longer part of the self-writing process within politics, and this, I'm afraid, has been one of the consequences of Trump, Johnson, Berlusconi, etc. Campbell has a point. The traditional media is struggling to keep up with the post-truth antics of politicians. And with the United States gearing up for another presidential election and Donald Trump currently leading in the polls, the political climate is likely to become wilder. But it's too easy to blame everything on the Fourth Estate. Don't get me wrong. Yes, I was appalled by the media's coverage of the referendum campaign as well as by its response to the referendum result. Yes, some takes were hysterical. Yes, many commentators produced more smoke than light. Yes, most analysis lacked perspective. And yes, the media's systemic failure to inform is one of the major reasons why Australia struggles to properly debate everything from climate change to the pandemic to tax reform to nuclear submarines to reconciliation. But that cannot be the only reason why collectively we chose to vote no and to remain captive to our colonial history. There were other factors in play, namely racism, the lack of bipartisan support for The Voice, the splitting of the Yes campaign into two camps, the interventions of Senators Lydia Thorpe, Jacinta Price and Pauline Hanson. Fundamentally, though, I believe that John Howard is the main reason why more than 60% of voters said no. Let me explain why Howard deserves the credit for this national disgrace. The leaders of dead governments are like Hamlet's ghost. They tend to linger in the wings of the national stage, alert to any opportunity to free themselves from post-political purgatory. That's why Scott Morrison recently donned the Kevlar vest to tour Hamas attack sites in Israel. That's why Malcolm Turnbull keeps campaigning against Rupert Murdoch. That's why Tony Abbott, newly appointed to the board of Fox Corporation by Lachlan Murdoch, keeps nattering on about climate change. And that's why Kevin Rudd reinvented himself as Australia's chief diplomat in the United States. The fact that Julia Gillard escaped this karmic afterlife suggests she's made of sterner stuff than her alpha male contemporaries. As for Howard and Paul Keating, the patriarchs of the Liberal and Labor clans, they reside on different planes. Keating, as demonstrated by his recent eulogy for former Labor leader Bill Hayden and his intemperate attacks on Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong, remains an agitator for reformist nationalist government. Howard, by comparison, seems content to spend his political afterlife watching Test cricket because, although he lost government in 2007 and saw his rosebud work choices consigned to the flames, he knows Australia remains in his political shadow. After all, the Australia we now live in, a maddening country of haves and have-nots, winners and losers, us and them, is the product of Howard's decades-long efforts to turn Australia into a Neighbour-style remake of Margaret Thatcher's United Kingdom. You need to go back to 2001 to understand how Howard remade Australia. At the beginning of that year, Howard seemed headed for defeat at the federal election. The economy had gone backwards with the introduction of the goods and services tax. One Nation's Pauline Hanson was gearing up for a return to Canberra. Voter satisfaction with Howard had sunk to 40%, and among Labor brethren, Kim Beazley was spoken of sotto voce as a PM in waiting. What happened next changed Australian politics. Howard used the 2001 budget to buy his way back into contention. Then, before and after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he hit the jackpot with his opportunistic decision to treat the arrival of refugees on boats as a security threat rather than as a humanitarian crisis. And in the process, miraculously delivered a 3.4% swing to the coalition at the November 2001 election. Needless to say, federal Labor was destroyed. In fact, the aftershocks of 2001 still rattle in some Labor circles. One reason why Howard still reverberates is that the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd governments lack the unity to stay in power long enough to reset the lingua franca of campaigning and governing and to expunge Howard. The 2013 election of Abbott, a man who once described himself as the political love child of Howard and Bronwyn Bishop, extended the afterlife of the former member for Bennelong. Then we had Bill Shorten, who tried and failed to end the Howard era with a crash or crash through policy platform. Next came Albanese, who took a different tack. In opposition, Albanese ran a small target campaign. In government, he has focused on administrative competence, repairing fences with China and Australia's Pacific neighbours, and rubber stamping Morrison era policies, the Stage 3 tax cuts and the AUKUS deals, that will define Australia domestically and internationally for at least the next decade. Albanese is playing for time, planning to outlast Howard's ghost by emulating Bob Hawke and governing for at least three election cycles. In the meantime, he has been planning to differentiate Labor by adopting first-term reforms, such as the National Anti-Corruption Commission and The Voice, that are high on symbolism and, in terms of recurrent expenditure, low on cost. The disastrous referendum result, backed by less than 4 in 10 voters and 0 states, puts those short-term plans in jeopardy and brings Dutton back into electoral contention. Albanese grossly underestimated the opponents of The Voice, much as former British PM David Cameron underestimated the proponents of Brexit. In hindsight, Albanese's promise to hold the Voice referendum during his first term was a Rudd-like mistake. More about the idea than the implementation. A more strategic approach would have been in the immediate aftermath of the 2022 election to prepare the ground for a decade-long path to reconciliation and treaty by legislating a Voice to Parliament, knowing a future coalition government would find it difficult to kill off a legislated Voice with a teal and green dominated Senate. With the referendum defeated, however, a legislated Voice is now impossible, and according to Indigenous academic Marcia Langton, reconciliation is dead. I hope Langton is wrong. I hope the reconciliation and treaty efforts of Victoria and South Australia create new precedents for federal political action. But the political realist in me worries that the failure of the Voice referendum is a major setback for Indigenous self-determination. Not only that, Albanese has needlessly surrendered the political momentum. Over the summer and throughout 2024, Dutton will attempt to take control of the national agenda and define the narrative of the next federal election campaign, attacking Albanese's broken promise to relieve cost of living pressures and using the conflicts in the Ukraine and Gaza to stoke national security fears. Of course, Albanese has the power of government at his disposal and should be able to wrest back momentum and reset the political agenda. But, as John Howard showed in 2001, none of this will matter if Australia finds itself on the wrong side of a wildcard event such as the re-election of Trump or the escalation of wars in the Ukraine or Gaza. Anything is possible now.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Book Review podcast. Join us again next week. If you enjoyed this episode, why not consider subscribing to ABR? Subscriptions start from just $10 a month for full digital access. Visit our website for more information. We'd like to thank Stacey Jan, who edits the podcast, as well as our contributors who take the time to read their articles and creative writing. And if you enjoy listening to the ABR podcast, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes.